It's like we've gone quite a full basket tonight. This morning I had my brightest, deepest, most still meditation ever. As I sensed the hour coming to an end, I counted my breaths down from 100, knowing you would ring the bell during that time. When I got to zero, no bell. So I decided to hold my breath till I heard the bell. Luckily, you rang it right then. Question, what did the Buddha teach regarding synchronicities? Actually, nothing that I know of. Certainly one of the things with that the Buddha did teach was one of the things that are seen as unfathomable or hard to conceive or hard to find the end of in the same way as it's hard to find the end all of the intricacies of karma. It's the same thing as finding the and trying to figure out all of the things that can come from the power of a concentrated mind. Okay, this is just a comment. Dear Ajahn, a simple and sincere thank you for your guided meditation this morning. I look forward to the CD. Yeah, actually, that's the great thing of recording, is that they can go back and review them and listen to them again if there's something that's useful. Okay, Ajahn, how are you doing? Is teaching a retreat as busy as being involved at the monastery? It is so pleasant to have a group of monastics here. The chanting and the whole energy is like sweet medicine. Wishing you all well, and thank you so much for coming here. Well, they do more teaching on retreat, but there's no building committee meetings. There's no there's no sort of other sort of meetings that involve like meeting contractors and different things that are happening inevitably in a monastery. So, I mean, I'm enjoying being on retreat with you all. So that. Yes. Dear Rajan, today there'll be hundreds and thousands of turkeys killed for Thanksgiving dinner. Can we dedicate our evening chanting to them? May they be reborn as humans and practice Dhamma. Thanks. That's one of the things. Oftentimes in Thailand, when they're teaching and festival days, and the monks, when they're sort of giving teachings on festival days, and oftentimes one of the reflections is, you know, people tend to get really excited about festival days and whatnot. And just, animals don't. they end up sort of being in the pots and on the plates, and that's not much fun at all. Ajahn, what did the Buddha say about karma in relationship to our parents and siblings? How do we end up in these families? Yeah, it's a good time to do a Thanksgiving retreat, isn't it? sometimes like Thanksgiving being the time when you get to sort of be with people you'd only see once a year, and then you realize that that's actually too much. one of the things that the Buddha definitely said is the gratitude to parents. because they're there, and one does have a, and even in the, there's a kind of a form, stock phrase in the suttas about the like right view, like conventional right view or worldly right view, and that and it speaks to the nature of karma. One, that there is karma, there's the results of karma, there's and part of the phrasing is that there is mother and father, in the sense that we do have a special relationship with them, and you know, it can be fraught in many ways, but it's also it is a primary relationship, and they did feed us and clothe us and get us to this point, and of being able to grow up to be an adult, so that there is a recognition of that gratitude. And then, you know, in an ideal world, then there's these supportive, loving relationships. Of course, we don't live in an ideal world, and so that some relationships are more complicated than others. But I think it's always helpful. At least they gave us life, and that's the we've been able to grow up to this degree of being adults and able to seek the Dhamma, and that in itself is enough. You know, and similarly, for some reason, you know, karma draws us to, and that's the nature of karma. It draws us to certain situations, and we end up in situations of having parents and siblings, and sometimes, you know, you wonder how they, you know, can be quite dissimilar. But there's a certain trust that there's a karma behind that. There's a draw, a pull, an impetus through our past associations. And it's really helpful just think in those terms, so that we're trying to find ways to, especially if it is a fraught relationship, then how to sort of be in that situation without complicating it even more and entangling ourselves to an even greater degree. So then that the cultivation of wholesome qualities of gratitude, appreciation, loving kindness, compassion, those are extremely helpful. And then, you know, with very strong loving relationships, how can we maintain a sense of independence and clarity, so that we can also seek the Dhamma? Because if we're being bound by bonds of love and attachment, they're just the other side of the coin, being bound by bonds of enmity and aversion. So that being able to really look at the ways that one can bring really skillful, wholesome qualities into our relationships with parents and siblings. There's no stickiness there. There's no complications that we're creating. As mindfulness has increased, I find fighting drowsiness directly can empower it. I'm drawn to stepping into the experience, feeling the strong pull into mental proliferation, and gently grounding the mind back into stronger physical feeling. I slip in repeatedly, but find that I can eventually make the mind stable and bright. Is this a handy strategy or a more long-term approach in knowing and dismantling the hindrances? I think one of the things that is very true in the sense of, you know, we can wear ourselves out fighting defilements. And that it empowers them when we're, when it's from a place of vibhava-tanha, trying to annihilate it, pushing it away. There is a balance where one has a sense of recognition of a particular hindrance or defilement, and then being able to be present with it, recognizing its drawback, but then being very patient with its presence. But then, you know, one's mind is set on a goal beyond it as well, and that allows the mind to eventually become stable and bright. And the main thing in terms of a strategy, the bottom line is always, does it work or does it not work? And that's when we experiment with different techniques and try this out and try that out. And you always have to come back and say, well, did it work? And then you gain a body of knowledge and confidence if it works, and you gain knowledge and confidence if it doesn't work, in the sense, okay, that didn't work, so I got to try something else. So there's a more clear sense of how to work with the hindrances. When preparing to meditate, is it better to have going in an issue that you want to spend your time on, or to get into the meditation and allow the mind to settle on an issue that arises? Again, it's that sense of, well, what works? What's helpful? And you'll probably, as you continue practicing, you'll probably be doing both at different times. Both work when they work, and so you get, you get skillful with it, and you get skillful with it. And so, because sometimes just letting the mind settle, and then allow something to come up, then it's what's percolating out of the quiet mind. And so that's relevant, and that needs to be addressed. At other times, there's already an issue going on, and one takes that as an object of reflection, and then working with that. So it's more what's appropriate in the circumstance, rather than starting our meditations with some kind of conceptual expectation that I should be doing this in order to be meditating, where give yourself the space to experiment. The talks, Q&A, and the instruction have all been so helpful. Thank you. So appreciate that. Sometimes you lead a retreat and you give talks and am I just talking to the wind or what? Does this mean anything to anybody? Buddha wasn't tortured like Jesus. Why did he set such high standards to tolerate pain with equanimity? Almost impossible to do for a human. Maybe some Tibetan monks can endure Chinese torture in such a detached way. The thing is for the Buddha was interested in liberation and the complete ending of suffering. So that anywhere that that arises, he was willing to work with it. So the standard is sort of there because that's what's needed to be really liberated. And everybody has a different experience or path. I mean, there's a teaching where the Buddha says there's these four different types of practitioners. There's practitioners who practice with a lot of pain and difficulty and understand things quickly. There's practitioners who practice with a lot of pain and suffering and difficulty and understand slowly. And then there's practitioners who experience with a lot of ease and happiness and understand quickly. And then there's those who practice with a lot of ease and happiness and they understand slowly. So that different people experience the practice in different ways. How does one contemplate the eight worldly dhammas? So the worldly dhammas of praise and blame, gain and loss, sort of renown and ill repute, and pleasure and pain. So that those are, I think, just by contemplating that these are, you know, more or less what encompass experience in the world. And say the habit or the impulse, the very deep conditioning, of course, is to want to experience praise and happiness and gain to have a good repute, to have a good name, and nobody wants the blame and the suffering and the ill repute and loss. But the reality is, even if you're a fully enlightened Buddha, it's just what happens. I mean, things change. And the Buddha at times was blamed, he was criticized. You don't escape that I'm going to practice Dhamma and meditation and I'm going to become enlightened so I don't have to be blamed for anything. And I said, good luck. It just doesn't work that way. In the same way that there's always some sort of loss or that sense of one experiences physical suffering, and as a say even an enlightened being, they get beyond the kind of the mental suffering, but there's still physical suffering. Having a body that's subject to old age, sickness, and death, and subject to tiredness, subject to hunger. Those are all very natural things that we... So that in terms of contemplating the eight worldly dhammas is seeing their naturalness and then to just be able to identify. That's what that is, so in the sense of... Because sometimes we're praised and then, we start... there's a Thai idiom, sort of like when somebody's starts to get a bit full of themselves, their ears pick up and their tail stands out, So because it is just a worldly dhamma, even praise is You don't want to be taking it seriously. You don't want to be taking it personally. And then, of course, the same with criticism or blame. And this is, it's like Ajahn Chah. I said, you've got to be able to understand yourself and have a clear sense of your own integrity or well-being or whatever. And he said, in Thailand, if you want to really speak the harshest kind of language and revile somebody, you call them a dog, and that's really bad. It's not these sort of fluffy ones that are around in the you call it. And Ajahn Chah, I remember him saying, you know, even if somebody calls you a dog, you know, all you have to do is look and see if you've got a tail. If you don't, why do you have to believe them? No, it's just that sort of, okay, you've seen that. These are just worldly dhammas. And is it true? Whether it's praise or blame or gain or loss, is it true? And even if it is true, it's still going to be impermanent. So there's no big deal to it. It's just worldly dhammas. Will the instructions be available after the retreat? CD, download them? Yeah, I'm sure it's all being recorded, and we almost invariably have CDs available, and it usually gets put up on the website. I don't know when or how, but they appear at times. And could you explain the Sangha described in the chants versus lay Sangha? Well, I think I mentioned the other night, Sangha in the chants is actually neither monastic nor lay. It's those practitioners, followers of the Buddha, who have practiced well, practiced directly, practiced insightfully, practiced with integrity, and have experienced the fruits of the practice to whatever degree. And that's the kind of the highest ideal of Sangha. Conventional Sangha is is a monastic Sangha, having the wearing robes and shaving the head, and then there's sort of the Sangha in a broader sense is then all of the sort of the followers of the Buddha, and it's rarely used. In Sangha, usually in speaking with specifically of lay people, it's rarely used as sort of lay Sangha, but it's more like when the laity speaking of followers is like Purisa, which is specifically the lay community. So that there's different ways of using Sangha, and it's fairly narrowly defined, and then it extends out to the conventional, and extends out to sort of encompass everybody. But then, the word traditionally, when one uses sort of like lay Sangha, then it's more like the Buddha Purisa, the followers of the Buddha. If I understand this afternoon's reflection correctly, then the body is capable of responding to things independent of the mind. So though I may have learned to refrain from facial, verbal, and outer expressions of anger, impatience, humiliation, etc., the body may still respond. As I sit now, day after day, I feel all of that stored up tension in my neck and waves of anxiety in my belly. How to help the body release the pent-up emotions I have stuffed? I think it's just really helpful to recognize that we do, we stuff it in and the body holds it. And we can be, And of course, there's a two-way communication going on in that. The mental state drifts into and bleeds into a feeling in the body. The body is sort of responding or feeling in a particular way, and then it generates a mental state. And so that they go back and forth, and just the attention to really softening, relaxing, attending to, because when we pay attention, even if there is tension, we can also direct attention to a place where there isn't sort of tension. So there's ways of working with it, so that we can consciously relax, or we can consciously direct attention to a place where we're not feeling tightness and tension. So then that helps to release. So that there's many ways of working with that. And to me, and of course I'm biased, but mindfulness of breathing has such a powerful effect on the sort of the whole body mind, and particularly the body, that just that rhythm of the breath, when we really let it move through our whole body, our whole being, it has a very relaxing, very soothing quality to it, as well as brightening and energizing as the mind becomes more still. So that working with the breathing and making the breathing conscious, and that's actually something that the Buddha, when the Buddha praises mindfulness of breathing, he says, "When I practiced mindfulness of breathing, neither my body was tired nor my eyes were tired." One of the common meditations at the time of the Buddha was using a visual object that one would stare at until one got an image in the mind, and then you start to hold the image in the mind to concentrate on. So your eyes get tired doing that sometimes. And then the body being tired, if one's, as a methodology of practice, it's just a part of having a physical body, and it gets tired. But then the mindfulness of breathing that's really permeating sort of just the whole body, it has a rejuvenating quality to it. It has a soothing quality to it. So then, and then of course that helps the mental states to settle. Is there a Buddhist equivalent or analog to the soul? There is. It's that which causes suffering. that sense of, because that sense of soul is this thing, there's some intrinsic, separate kind of me in there. And that assumption is the seed for so much suffering. It's also interesting. I mean, like with the word anatta as not, say, non-self, and early Buddhist translators used to call it, no soul, and you say to counteract the very strong Christian teaching and belief systems. But say anatta, as non-self or not self, is that's your middle way. In the Pali language, the word for self is atta. So there's atta, that sense of self, the holding to a sense of individual selfhood, soul, that either is sort of indestructible and whatever merges with the universe or reincarnates for an eternity for you and never dies, sort of thing. But that sense of atta itself is an extreme position that is conducive to suffering, because it isn't in accord with reality. The other extreme is viratta, which is like negation of self, negating or annihilation of self, annihilation of soul. And then the anatta of non-self or not-self is your point of balance, where you're starting to recognize that this body, this mind, these mental states, if it were really self or soul, then we should have some sort of control over it. Or at least a decent self or soul would. but it's a bad deal when it changes all the time. So it's just not worth calling it a soul. So that sense of seeing the non-self nature of phenomena, both physical and mental, that's your place of balance for finding peace. Dear Rajan, when you do anapanasati, do you do all 16 steps in a row? When or how do you decide to move on to the next step? Or is it more free form than that? Thank you. It's much more free form in that sometimes it's a really good exercise just to take, you know, the 16 steps and just work through it in some kind of sequential fashion. It's a reminder. It helps to structure the mind. But that isn't. It's only something that I would do from time to time. Then even picking and choosing different aspects, it doesn't necessarily mean that you even do it, say, one following the other. You can pick it up anywhere in those instructions, and it'll be fruitful, it'll be beneficial. And then at different times, different aspects will be more relevant or even more interesting. And again, that's really also one of the benefits of having 16 steps to Anapanasati, is it's very much the nature of the mind to either become bored with something if you do it over and over again, or inured to it. You just get so used to it, you're going on automatic pilot. So that by having the thread of continuity is the breath, but then the way you apply it and the perspectives that you take while you're doing it, those can change, and it keeps it fresh and keeps it interesting. And that's important in the practice, because we start to understand things that we're interested in, and when we take that interest. Okay. What is the difference in practice between mindfulness, vipassana, insight, and concentration, samatha? How does directed and non-directed practice fit here? And since, as I understand, the idea is to build continuity, what about time not in formal practice? Thanks. Well, first thing is that the say the mindfulness tends to say is not equated with vipassana or insight. That is, say vipassana insight practice, reflection, investigation. That's its own sort of practice. Relies on mindfulness as a foundation. Requires mindfulness in order to be effective. Concentration, samatha, like tranquility, stability of mind, firmly establishing the mind, that also requires mindfulness. Mindfulness is your bridge for all of the and the foundation for all of the practices. Yeah, and definitely the sense of continuity, the time that's not in formal practice, on a certain level is actually more important than the formal practice, in that because it's we spend more time in ordinary circumstances than we do in formal practice. So that really placing importance and seeing the value in trying to bring that mindfulness and discernment into to all of the things we do. And then, of course, that's why precepts are when we speak of continuity of practice, the continuity also comes from the conditions that we set up and establish around us, because it's not just a mental exercise that one's doing. It's living one's life, and the cultivation of using the precepts as a basis for skillful action, and refraining from unskillful action, because those unskillful actions lead to a dissonance in the mind. They lead to agitation. They lead to problematic relationships with people in the world around us. So that just the basic five precepts are tremendous protection for oneself in trying to build that continuity in practice, so that it's something that helps protect the Dhamma. And also in terms of continuity in practice, is that paying attention to opportunities for the cultivation of spiritual qualities, the barmi of generosity, of virtue, of patience, of different being able to put forth effort in things, and being able to adhere to truth and truthfulness, to loving kindness, to have determination. All those are what are called barmi. They're spiritual qualities, and those help provide a continuity, a kind of an anchor and a stability and a brightening to the mind. Also, paying attention to the having good friends in Dhamma, being associating with people who are supportive and share a common aspiration or standard of living, that's extremely helpful for that continuity of our practice. Okay, regarding the bare mind, separate from its objects, which of the five aggregates is it? Presumably, even this mind is impermanent. Yes? Yep. that's impermanent also. But but what it does is give a window on a window of opportunity for freedom, a window of opportunity for stillness and peace. So that, and you know, it's not when we speak of the mind, the five aggregates, so body, sort of is the physical aspect, and one can see that that is separate. But when we speak of the mind, within the five aggregates, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. You can't really separate it out. It isn't really completely discrete and standing alone. So there is a series of questions and answers with a senior monk, Mahakotita, with Sariputta, and he asks, you know, is feeling, perception, and consciousness, are these conjoined or disjoined? Can they be described separate from each other? Sariputta says, the feeling, perception, consciousness, these are conjoined, they're not disjoined, they can't be. You use language as a tool to describe function so that you can pay attention in different ways, but the reality is that they're bundled up together, and there's those different aspects of experience conjoined together, and that constitutes the mind. Can one enter the absorptive state through mindful breathing, or is single-pointed jhana meditation required? Well, actually, mindfulness of breathing is the most common jhana meditation that's taught in the discourses and most contemporary teachers that I know, because it does have a quality of quite naturally a quality of ease to it, then it's a nice transition to being able to unify the mind. You know, and I think it's helpful to recollect that the when the Buddha describes the jhanas, these states of absorption and states of unification, that when he describes them, particularly the first three jhanas, there it's all of the imagery is experiencing it in the body. So it's not some sort of out-of-body one-pointedness that one is completely disassociated with one's normal experience, and one is completely sort of absorbed in the mind. It's a full body mind experience that is unified and settled and stable, and that's one of the reasons why it's so rejuvenating and brightening, because it's affecting everything. Okay. I'm struggling with body pain while sitting in meditation. I realize shifting my body position causes me to temporarily lose my concentration. At times I can sit with the pain, other times I'm concerned that I may be injuring my back and or knees. how is most beneficial to work with this? Well, one of the things is just the recognition that, you know, pain in the body is quite ordinary. You have to adjust the posture, and one of the things in terms of paying attention to posture, so that there's not too much strain, because sometimes a lot of pain that we experience is the strain that we're putting the body in by trying to sit up straight, trying to sit for a longer period of time, so that to, you know, give oneself the opportunity to consciously relax, and sometimes with body pain, just very conscious where one's feeling pain, to, because they say the normal reaction is to be repelled by it and to be averse to it and to be intimidated by it, but to just allow the mind to approach the pain and go. And again, that's the mindfulness of breathing. It's sort of like really breathing through the pain, and relaxing and pervading it with a sense of softening and kindness. And oftentimes, that's enough to dissipate the pain and discomfort. Other times, it's just way more practical to shift your position. You know, just to give yourself a break. I mean, especially in a retreat, doing many hours of meditation a day. Our bodies aren't used to it, and it can be uncomfortable. It can be painful. So that to give yourself the opportunity to recognize, okay, this is painful. My knees are really hurting, and or my back is hurting. Now, how do I adjust that? So there's that mindful recognition, you know, and setting the intention. Okay, I think I'm gonna. I've worked with this enough. I don't see it dissipating or shifting. I'm going to shift position. So that mindfully setting that intention, mindfully shifting. Then sustaining the mindfulness through that and then settling it. It's really not much of a disturbance to do that. If you take it as an exercise in mindfulness. Because also, if the pain just keeps building, that's a distraction as well. It's hard to concentrate when there's a lot of pain. Or you say, maybe I'll go and do walking meditation, or go and do standing meditation. And those are all valid ways of working with pain, working with discomfort in the body, sitting in a chair, sitting in the position. There's we've got lots of options, but all of those options, we need to be cultivating mindfulness and discernment, and because that's the heart of the practice. It's not being able to sit for long periods of time. It's like Ajahn Chah said. Somebody asked him, is it necessary to sit for long periods of time for meditation to be successful? And he said, chickens sit on their nest for long periods of time. I don't see them getting enlightened. So that it's just making it comfortable and recognizing. It means I just shifted now. I said, okay, my knees are sore, and that I'm just making a shift. And it's just you're dealing with it. If it starts to become, because there's also, you have to be, because we can sometimes obsess out of anxiety, the least little twinge. Oh dear, it's I can't stand this. Shift back, trying to, but you're never going to be comfortable in a human body. I can assure you that. And so it's just like, okay, just how can I relax? Okay. Please speak about, quote, unburdened with duties, unquote. So it's in the Buddha's words on loving kindness. And I notice it's not one unburdened by duties. Not that this isn't also good advice. Does this mean we should attempt to minimize our responsibilities? What does this have to do with metta? And it's a sort of sign from a chronically busy person. So that, and it's exactly that kind of busyness and engaging that is, you know, sometimes we're compelled to be doing things, engaging in things, because we don't know how to settle or we don't know how to be with ourselves. So we just keep that level of activity going. It's also as that distinction of unburdened with duties in the sense that, you know, there's inevitable duties that we take on as human beings in all of our various roles, and to learn how to not be burdened by them, not to carry them around or to make judgments of I was successful or I'm a hopeless failure, or the worries and fears and anxieties or the planning mind and all, because that's way more of a burden than actually doing different tasks and chores and duties. It's sort of how we hold it. Sometimes it's helpful to minimize some responsibilities that we see are distracting for us, or that are bound up with some kind of negativity, or just keep us way too busy than we need to be. And in terms of what does it have to do with metta? I mean, metta is loving kindness. And if we keep ourselves agitated and busy, and it's not very kind to ourselves, and to just learning how to be kind to oneself first. It's like in the chant that begins, "May I abide in well-being," that sort of loving kindness, compassion. When we generate loving kindness, we generate it to ourselves first, and then you say, "May everyone abide in well-being." So that's we really need to learn how to direct that metta, that loving kindness, to ourselves. And the but all of that being said, and there are inevitable kind of duties and responsibilities and living in a monastery. I mean, people have projections sometimes of all those monks in the monastery. They're able to meditate all the time. And anybody who's actually come and visited or lived in the monastery knows that, yeah, there's a lot to look after. There's a lot to deal with. There's a lot to that needs to be done. But then learning how to not be burdened with those various duties. as well as getting a balance of, okay, giving oneself some very clear time that is doesn't have anything, where you can focus on that internal solitude. Okay, might you, kind sir, expound on the aspect of right intention? Also, are the five spiritual powers meant to be the positive side of the coin in correlation to the five hindrances? Also, what is Sangveka? And then in brackets, no pressure to answer all three. Okay, right intention or right resolve is the intention or resolve towards renunciation and then to non-ill will and non-harming. Say, like, wrong intention, wrong resolve is sensual desire, ill will, thoughts of harming. And that right intention is, in another sense, is a sort of generosity, loving-kindness, compassion. That's what it results in. One of the ways that the Buddha taught, because he was very precise, rather than say, you know, to have right resolve, you know, so having thoughts of renunciation, as opposed to, you know, you constantly have to be having thoughts of generosity and giving. And sort of, okay, I can have it, because that's doable. And in the same way, of having thoughts of non-ill will, rather than, you know, you've got to have thoughts of loving kindness all the time. Because that's, say, it's very idealistic. If we can just sort of keep to non-ill will and non-harming, that in itself gives some space. Yeah. And then opens the doors to the other more refined states, but is it in that? So that right intention is that resolving in ways that help to support those qualities in mind that are not bound up with what's unskillful or negative. And the five spiritual powers are not directly connected to the as an in opposition or in correlation to the five hindrances, but they're a helpful tool for five spiritual powers: faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. So that those are the kind of spiritual faculties that we need to be cultivating. And Sangveka is the sense of there's a spiritual urgency, a spiritual motivation, but it's not frantic. It's because it's Sangveka is a very positive state that sort of says, yeah, there's I can't waste time. I can't muck about here. I really need to knuckle down and keep working on this. But when the Buddha describes different mental states, so that Sangveka is a kusala citta, it's the mind of kusala, so that it's wholesome, it's skillful. And inherently in that, say, that quality of it being kusala or wholesome is that it's steady, it's associated with well-being, it has a level of discernment to it, so that by its very nature, it isn't, you know, when we say, you know, like spiritual urgency, it's not there, it isn't fretting, because if it were fretting, that would be an akusala mental state. It would be an unwholesome or unskillful mental state. So it's like it's a brightening quality to the mind that is ready to put forth effort and not waste time. Okay, today I had pure moments of concentration on bliss. No matter what I did, I felt fully present, aware, mindful. Does that mean I was an enlightened being for a few minutes? Too bad I lost concentration when I started writing this. No, what it means is that you were fully present, aware, and mindful. And those are the tools. Those are what we keep cultivating that, and it has a it has the motivating factor of concentration of on bliss. It makes one want to do it more. Okay, last one. Okay. There's a very neat, orderly mind behind this. What or how was the father-son relationship of the Buddha and his son Rahula? Are there any suttas, teachings in regards to their own relationship and of their family? Rahula was just a young boy when the Buddha came back the first time to Kapilavatthu, which is where he grew up. And his mother said to ask the Buddha for your inheritance. And Rahula came up to the Buddha and sort of had this feeling of kind of awe, appreciation, the coolness of being in the Buddha's presence. And of course, the Buddha gave him his inheritance. He ordained him as a novice. and then taught and trained him. And it doesn't actually say at what age Rahula became fully enlightened, but I think it was in his early adulthood that he was fully enlightened. And there's a very lovely teaching that the Buddha gives to Rahula when Rahula is still a fairly young boy, young novice. And it's just around proper speech and engaging one's actions through that, in the sense of, somebody who tells a deliberate lie, and this is this. And he uses a dipper or a dish with water, and with many illustrations of you see this little bit of water and somebody who's doesn't speak the truth is sort of they're just sort of that, like that little bit of water, you see that little throws it away, you see that little bit that water that was thrown away, somebody who doesn't hold to the truth has sort of thrown their virtue away. There's just these illustrations to a young boy. You see this empty dish. And so in the same way, somebody who doesn't adhere to truth, they've emptied themselves. So it's a very, very lovely teaching to a young boy. And the teaching that prior to Rahula was sort of a catalyst for the Buddha for Rahula's enlightenment was one day when he's going an alms round with the Buddha, and of course The Buddha's he would have been maybe late 40s. Yeah, late 40s, and that's sort of the peak of his, kind of presence and charisma and Rahul is sort of walking along, kind of behind and sort of looking at the Buddha and saying, the Buddha is, it's really a, awesome being, and he's has this presence about him, and he looks so sort of handsome and dignified, and and I'm his son, and probably got some of that too, sort of proliferating. And the Buddha turns around and sort of rebukes him for what's going on in his mind. How can I go on arms around him? After being rebuked by the Buddha, so he says, I better not go. So he goes off and practices meditation. And that's also where Sariputta comes along and then gives instruction on the, I think, in mindfulness of breathing. In the element. Do you remember that sutta? On the elements as well, isn't it?
And also asubha and loving kindness.
Oh, yeah, asubha and loving kindness. Anyway, it's a very comprehensive teaching, and that was a real catalyst for his getting down to the real roots of the practice. There's also, there was a rule in the Vinaya that was laid down when Rahula ended up without a place to sleep one night. Other monks had taken all the dwelling places, and then so that there is the Buddha laid a rule down to be because of feeling compassionate and responsible for his son, but then also the effect that would have for others. So there's sort of rules of decorum. There's a rule when monastics ordain, they need to have their permission from their parents. And that came about, I think it was after the ordination of Rahula. Of course, the Buddha left home and ordained. And then he ordained his cousin, Nanda, on his wedding day. That didn't go over very well with the family. And then he ordained Rahula and his son. And his father came and he said, it's like when you left home, that was just like pierced the heart, and was just, and then when Nanda, you ordained Nanda, and that was just so painful and distressing, but ordaining Rahula is just, it's like cut to the bone. He says, you should, please, if in the future, if you could make a rule that parents' permission should be sought before ordination. So that's a rule that is still sort of on the books and is held to. And that sort of because of that sort of family relationship of sort of the grandfather, the father, the Buddha's son. Okay, we had a long session this evening, just have a short break and come back for chanting.